Welcome to the Real Fix podcast, your fix of real life stories. I'm Hattie Bishop, I'm a journalist, and I help people share their stories with the national newspapers and magazines. Each week, I'll be joined by my colleagues from the news desk to introduce you to some incredible people telling their remarkable stories. First up, the mum from Wiltshire fighting for justice after her daughter was murdered in their family home.
There's an ambulance in the drive, and then there are about three or four police cars just on the road outside our house. But it looked like they'd been abandoned because they were sort of parked off on the pavement. And obviously I just jumped out of the car and went running towards the end of our drive. And that's where I saw Matt sobbing. A policeman stopped me and said, who are you? And I said, I'm her mother. What on earth happened? What's happened? What's happened? And he just looked at me and didn't say anything. And I looked at Matt and said, what's happened? And he was just crying. And that's when he said, Ellie's dead.
And the Randy couple who decided to put the spark back in their sex life by getting their pen and paper out and rating each other's performances.
We talk to each other about the notes, then we scrap it, you know, we scrap the notes, throw them away so that we don't focus on the negativity. But that's basically what we do. So we'll write up, we always have the notepad next to us, but it's not like we keep the notes. We never keep the notes because we don't. Sometimes, you know, if you're in the moment and you're enjoying sex and you're enjoying the intimacy, you won't get, you know, you're not going to get emotional about criticism. However, you know, if you're pissed off and you're reviewing your notes, you're like, actually, remember that time, you know.
But before that, we're off to Wiltshire. I'd like you to meet Carol now. She's a mum of two and always doted on her kids. Until one day, her 17-year-old daughter Ellie was ripped away from her. Ellie was brutally attacked and murdered by her ex-boyfriend whilst revising for her A-level exams in the family's kitchen, leaving her family heartbroken. I spoke to Carol and asked her what happened on that fateful day.
You know, what did you and your husband, what was your first impression of Thomas?
He just seemed like an ordinary boy, really. The first time he came round, he had dinner with Ellie. Just the two of them, I was in the kitchen still, and they were just talking, and he just seemed like a normal 17-year-old boy.
What was his personality like?
He was a bit quiet. And no, you did have to prize information out of him. For example, I was saying, what A-levels are you studying, and have you got any plans for the future? Have you got any idea what you'd like to do when you finish your A-levels? And that sort of thing. And it was a bit hard work extracting information from him. But again, I just thought, he's a 17-year-old boy. It's the first time he's met me. You know, they can be a bit shy, can't they, 17-year-olds? Mm. I honestly didn't think anything of it.
And were you quite kind of happy that Ellie was, you know, in her first relationship? Does she seem quite happy with Thomas?
She seemed happy. I suppose I thought he had been friends with parents who are good friends of ours. Their sons had known him a long time. So I suppose I was quite reassured by that, that if he's friends of friends, he must be okay. I didn't overanalyze it. I just thought they're just sick formers and they're 17 and that's it, really.
Yeah. And when did, you know, the relationship start to change a little bit? When did kind of the warning signs come about with Thomas?
About a week beforehand. So that week before the run-up, the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, that weekend before, she told me that she was revising on the Sunday, and she told me when we went for a walk on the Sunday afternoon that he'd been pestering her to go over there on the Saturday evening, and she had told him she didn't want to. She wanted to stay with me because I had a friend over that I hadn't seen for many years, and she thought it would be fun to stay with me and listen to our stories from when we were younger. But she told me on the Sunday that Griffiths had been pestering her all evening to go over to his house, and she said, no, I don't want to. So I detected a bit of a drift then. Mm. And then her and I went for a walk on the Sunday afternoon, and she seemed very quiet. And I asked her what was wrong, and she just said, oh, it's just schoolwork, it's schoolwork. I've got these exams and I'm fed up with revising and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I think underlying, I think he was giving her a hard time. And then it was on the Thursday evening, she was quiet again. And that's when I said to her, are you all right? And she said it was, and she told me what had been going on that week at school with Griffiths and the pressure he, you know, he was acting odd. That's what she said. He kept saying to her, does it not bother you that we don't see each other after school this week? And she said, not really, because we're seeing each other in the day. I don't understand what your problem is. And then she said he would then say, I'm sorry, I'm sorry.
Mm.
Just odd behaviour.
Yeah.
And then they were playing in the sixth form a game, Hungry Hippos, and he wouldn't join in, and he just sat there on his phone. And he had a go at her in front of the others, I believe, saying, oh, you're just leaving me out. You're ignoring me. And she snapped back at him and just said, why don't you just put your phone down for once and join in with us? Or, you know, he was obviously jealous, wasn't he? He felt there was a rift coming. And I think it was on that Thursday when he was just telling her what she can and can't do. She thought, I'm not putting up with this. And that's what she told me on the Thursday evening, that, you know, he'd been acting really strange. And I said to her, oh, you don't want to be going out with somebody like that, Ellie, that tries to control you and tells you what you can do. And she went, no, I know I don't, Mum. Don't worry, I'll sort it.
What do you remember from that day? I know, because you were at work, weren't you? You know, what was the process of that day for you?
Well, it was a normal morning. I said goodbye to her in the morning. We had a discussion about after school, about her going up to the stables. She wasn't going into school that morning because she didn't have lessons on a Friday morning. And because she had these exams looming, she said she would stay at home and revise, because if she went into school, she would get distracted by her friends. And she said she had arranged with her friend Ellie Welling to come and pick her up at lunchtime. And Ellie Welling had passed a driving test, so that's why she was coming to pick her up.
Mm.
And they were both going to history together. So we said our goodbyes, and I said, I'll see you later. We'll go up to the stables. It should be a nice evening. And she said, oh, I'd like to do some jumping in the school tonight. And I said, great, I'll see you about four-ish. And that was that.
Did you get a phone call? How did you find out what had happened?
Because Matthew had gone home first. And yeah, walked in, and then he rang me hysterical about, I don't know, 3:10, and told me I had to leave because Ellie had a terrible accident.
So then did you kind of, you know, rush home? What were your next steps?
Yeah, I obviously jumped in the car and could, you know, your mind's racing, like, what on earth has she done? What's happened? I don't know, you just... You can't comprehend really what he means. I kept thinking, he doesn't like blood, so maybe she's just cut a finger. That's what I was thinking. She cut a finger. But then I was thinking, but why is she home? She shouldn't be home yet.
Mm.
And then I was thinking, maybe she didn't go into school afterward. After all, I don't know. So much stuff is running through your head, but you just want to get home and see what on earth happened. And of course, then there was a police car. I was sitting in traffic, and then a police car went past me with the sirens going, and you know, I tried to reassure myself saying, oh, that's nothing to do with it. And then of course I pull into our road, and it certainly was.
Yeah. So what scene were you met with then when you got home?
There were ambulances. There was an ambulance in the drive, and then there were about three or four police cars just on the road outside our house, but it looked like they'd been abandoned because they were sort of parked off on the pavement. Yeah, it was about three or four. So I couldn't even park near our house. I had to park up the road a bit. And also I just jumped out of the car and went running towards the end of our drive. And that's where I saw Matt sobbing.
Mm.
And then a policeman stopped me and said, who are you? And I said, I'm her mother. What on earth happened? What's happened? What's happened? And he just looked at me and didn't say anything. And I looked at Matt and said, what's happened? And he was just crying. And that's when he said, Ellie's dead.
Do you remember kind of your reaction to hearing that? What did you kind of say anything in return, or?
Oh, I think I just said, what's happened? Yeah, I don't know. You just those sort of words. What's happened? And then two lady police women sort of took our arms and said, is there anywhere we can go and sit? Is there anywhere we can go? And our immediate neighbours were at work, and then our other neighbours are quite elderly, and I just didn't want to shock them by going into their house. Mm. So they sat us in the back of the police car to start with. And then the next thing I was aware, the door opened and a detective put his head in and said, I introduced himself and said, so sorry. I don't know, did we have any questions? Well, no, you're just so shocked.
Mm.
And then the police ladies in the car started saying, who are her friends? What are their names? And I could only think of their first names. I couldn't think of their surnames because my mind was just going blank. And then they said to me, has she got a boyfriend? And I said, well, yes. And they said, what's his name? And his surname went out of my head. And then they were asking me where everybody lived, if I could remember their addresses.
Mm.
And again, it was all a bit patchy because you're... Anyway, and then the next thing, my phone goes and it's our son who lives in Oxford saying, Mum, what's going on? I can see on Facebook that our road's been cordoned off and there's an ambulance and police cars on our drive. And that was a terrible moment because I had to tell Ben on the phone.
Your husband kind of explained what happened. Was he aware that it, you know, wasn't an accident? Was that kind of...
No, we both didn't know what had happened at that point.
We
didn't know.
Okay.
Our neighbour had a good idea because he saw the knife in her neck.
Oh, really?
He told us later, yeah. So when Matt came in and found her, he obviously was horror-struck and dialed 999 straight away. But in his shock, he ran out of the house and knocked on our neighbour's door. And he came to help Matt and came in, and he did see.
When was it that you kind of found out that it was a crime, not just an accident? Was that something the police officers told you?
Yeah, it's when we were then taken to Melksham Police Station. We had some, what do they call them? Family liaison officers from Gloucester came down, Jackie and Steve, and they were lovely. And they sat in a room with us, and then Steve came in and said, we've got an update. We're investigating a murder inquiry. And I just felt, I don't know, I felt like somebody had thrown me against a wall in just disbelief that how could a young girl be murdered in her own home? And straight away we were saying, we don't understand it. She didn't have any enemies. Who would do that to her? Who would come in and do that? And then it was him that said, most often these cases, it's somebody known to them. And then Matt and I just looked at each other and said, it's the boyfriend, isn't it? It's the boyfriend. And that's when he said, I think you've worked it out for yourself. Anyway, the family liaison ladies were quite cross. She was quite cross. And she went, is Ben here? Is Ben here? And I said, yeah, he says he's in the room somewhere. And she just went, oh. And then she went out and obviously found him. But I just wonder whether they just shoved him in a room because at the same time maybe there was a commotion with Griffiths turning up.
Yeah.
And then I think they came back and said, we've got an update, we've arrested someone. And I remember saying, I hope you're not bringing that person here. I hope you're not bringing him here. And he went, no, that wouldn't happen. That wouldn't happen. But it did.
Yeah. So you were in the same building at the same time?
We were. So we were in the family suite and he was in a cell.
And was there any doubt in your mind that it might not be him, or were you pretty certain?
No, I knew it was him because I just thought it can't be anybody else.
Yeah.
She didn't have enemies. She was so light, you know, she just didn't. And we knew she wasn't involved in drugs or anything like that. So it had to be him.
obviously kind of out in the media and stuff is now, you know, Thomas's attempt to kind of cover up his tracks. And, you know, he's sending WhatsApp messages and Facebook, Snapchat messages to his friends. What was your reaction when you saw that?
I couldn't believe it. We knew that before. The police had told us what would come up in court beforehand. And I must admit, we were just shocked at how devious and manipulative and evil a young person could be, and how shocked that he's fooled. Not fooled, is that the right word? That he had, yeah, a psychopath like him hadn't been spotted before now. I think that was the shock. And the shock that, you know, I mean, somebody commits such a heinous crime that they could just carry on so calmly and do all that and sit in front of the teacher and the neighbour and, yeah, just at 17 as well. It's just unbelievable. There's been no red flags, and the police have said that. Nobody saw this coming. People have come forward and said to me that he was a bully at school. And there's some rumours that he was suspended in year 7 for bullying. But, you know, I don't know how much truth there is in that. Someone else said that he bullied her son all the way through primary school. And he was very coercive and controlling, making other children do things to her son. And it, you know, so it was never him that actually did it. So I think there were traits from a young age. But they just weren't that significant to be noticed, maybe.
And then, so how are you as a family kind of able to pick yourselves back up after the, you know, the court and the jail sentence and stuff? How are you able to carry on some sense of a normal life?
Well, we just have to, don't we? You don't have any choice. You've got to go back and try and work, pay the bills. You don't have any choice. It's hard. I think one thing that's keeping me going is the fight for justice. But obviously it's gone to the Attorney General and they see it as the correct sentence, which is quite hard to bear, really, because it doesn't feel justice at all. So I think all we can do is fight his parole and try and convince the state that he's very, very dangerous.
Wow, I think that the ability to carry on Ellie's legacy is admirable. She was clearly very loved by her family. To conclude that story, Griffiths admitted murdering Ellie and was jailed for a minimum of 12 and a half years at Bristol Crown Court. That was just another story brought to you by the team here at Real Fix. Hope you're enjoying all these inspirational stories, and don't forget you can download the full catalogue of Real Fix podcasts right now. Coming up in a moment, the Randy couple who decided to put the spark back in their sex life by getting their pen and paper out and rating each other's performances.
Would write something like, oh, you, this, the new method, for example, you're sucking too hard, or you're kind of licking aimlessly.
You need to kind of be a bit more gentle, or bite me a little bit harder.
Yeah, or kind of like put more pressure, you know, on the balls, or put more pressure on them.
That's one not to miss. But first, we're going to meet the lady who divided the opinion of our newsroom. Elena believes wives should submit to their husbands and women should be ladylike. She calls herself a trad wife and spends her days cooking and cleaning and keeping her home in perfect order, all to please her other half. She even offers courses to others who hope to become the perfect British housewife. Charlotte Penketh King, Harriet Rose Gale and Holly Sawyer started by asking her that very simple question. Why?
I think this is the thing. This is why a lot of us refer to the 1950s. So the people that kind of move in the same online social circles as I do. Because there is no definition or a modern definition of what a traditional housewife is. So referring to the 1950s, for us, that's kind of the last time the traditional housewife was celebrated for what she does. And what she did was is that she essentially ran her home like a business.
Right.
So the modern idea of a housewife is that you sit around eating biscuits all day and watching daytime television like loose women. And that's not the case at all. It's a bunch of women who are approaching their home life with great kind of business acumen. So economizing, budget managing, just trying to be the best housewife possible rather than almost what the media have portrayed us to be in recent decades.
Hmm. And when was it that you realised that that was the kind of role that you'd like to do, that you'd like to be a traditional housewife?
I always wanted to be a traditional housewife, actually. For probably the moment people started asking me, what do you want to do? You know, when you're a little girl, people would say ballerinas, or, you know, we have all these kind of ideals and they're really celebrated. But when I would say I wanted to be a housewife and a mum, they would often say to me, well, that's not a career. That's not enough. Don't you want to make something of yourself? And I personally was a bit confused by that, because that was my highest dream. So for me, it's always been that way. But a lot of women that are calling themselves trad wives have had careers as well. I've also had a career. But they didn't discover that that's where they truly wanted to be until they had children. So for me, it's always been the case, but lots of women are saying, actually, I'm really fulfilled at home and I want to be a traditional housewife. And I think the reason why people think it's a movement is because it's just not talked about, because it's almost something to be ashamed of, probably rightly so, because I'd always been told it wasn't enough. So you're not going to want to become kind of the black sheep, really, in society by calling yourself a traditional housewife.
Yeah.
We've always been here. It's just the fact that we're talking about it now, or I am, at least.
Yeah, you mentioned that you had a career in your early 20s. So was that just not making you happy then? Did you not enjoy it, or...?
No, I mean, there were parts that were enjoyable. You know, I got to exercise my creativity. I worked in marketing in the beauty industry. So they were always kind of like very girly fields that I was working in, very feminine kind of environments. But the office environment itself, I found incredibly toxic. I'm a bit of a homebody, if I'm honest, and I think a lot of traditional housewives are. You know, we want to focus our energy on pleasing our family. You know, because that's, you get most back from them, don't you? You know, when you've got a happy family, it feels like a lovely place to be. Whereas it always felt like, for me personally, in the working environment, I was constantly trying to please. And yet it was just met with negativity and not enough. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, and I think a lot of people do deal with that. There's a lot of toxicity in the corporate world. And that's just not where I found satisfaction or a sense of belonging. It was just at home for me. And lots of women feel the same.
And your husband, he's very supportive of your role as a traditional housewife, isn't he? And how did you two sort of have those discussions and decide that's what's best for your family?
Well, we're both quite traditional anyway in terms of our outlook. So it was something we didn't really discuss. It was almost like an unsaid thing. We definitely knew once we had children, I wouldn't go back to work, because it's very hard to as well. It's almost impossible for women to find work that works around school hours, holidays. And there's some that do really struggle with childcare in that time. So financially, it didn't actually make sense for me to go back to work, because I'd be paying the majority of my salary towards childcare. But I actually had a stint as a stay-at-home girlfriend before we even got married, actually, because I found myself in a job that I absolutely hated. And he said, just stay at home and almost recover from the stress of that for a little while. And I then took on the role of the traditional house girlfriend. What do you want to call that? And it really worked for us, actually. It was just a lifestyle that, you know, we weren't arguing over who was going to cook the dinner or do the dishes anymore. And it was where I flourished. This won't work for everybody, or it might work in reverse. You know, the man might be better at home and the woman obviously wants to have a career. It's just the fact that we are two halves of a whole. So I run the household. He does his job. When he gets home, that's his time off to relax. And then my role's in the home.
And what's a typical day involve for you as a traditional housewife?
Well, I would love to know what you think it involves, actually, because for me it's just always very simple, but I'd love to know from someone who's not living this lifestyle what they what
well
they think.
I imagine it's the complete opposite, because my house is often quite messy, so I can imagine that your house is probably immaculate and you're very organized in that, you know, I'm forever thinking, oh god, I've got to do this, I've got to do that, and you're probably exceptionally organized with, you know, your bills and everything like that, and I guess just managing your family in a sense, so knowing who's where, who's doing what, getting them there, getting them home, and making sure that everyone is fed and watered and where they need to be. That's how I imagine it. And am I wrong? I don't know. You tell me.
I've got it largely right. I'm no Mrs. Hinch. It's not about perfection. And this is kind of what I say with the Darling Academy. What we do is we don't create show homes. We create nests. There's a difference. So you could walk into a show home and you go, oh, isn't this lovely and clean? And you know, you've got to take your shoes off and you don't want to sit down and put anything out of place.
Yeah.
It's not about having that approach to running your home. It's about creating a haven. So when people come in your home, they go, oh, the stress of the world kind of melts away. So I'm not overly fussed if something's out of place or, you know, something has happened, like my son's been ill, so I haven't been able to do the hoovering or clean the kitchen. It's about being most responsive to my family's needs at that time. So I'm kind of just the one that's always there to greet them and give them a warm hug, feed and water them. And it can be disorganized at times as well, you know, especially in the summer holidays. The routine goes out the window when my son's home. But it's a case of it's my responsibility to make sure they're happy, they're fed, they're loved, and I'm always there.
Mm. And so what is it that you kind of enjoy most about your role then?
I just love being at home. And I think there are some people that just are real homebodies who are particularly enamoured with domestic things. So there are women who love to bake, women who love to sew, men too, I suppose. I can only ever speak from personal experience of being a woman. A lot of people are saying this seems really sexist, but I've got no experience of being a stay-at-home dad, so I can't speak for them. But yeah, so just some people flourish with domestic pursuits, and I'm one of those people. And I think that's why I wanted to set up the Darling Academy, is because we don't have domestic science at school anymore. So people are leaving school ready for the world of work, and they don't know how to run a household efficiently, or they don't know how to budget, or they don't know how to even cut an onion up. You know, what's the point in learning about algebra when you can't feed yourself? You know, so everybody has to go out to work, of course, or most people do, but absolutely everybody needs to run a household. So I think we should be learning more of those skills, and it should be more important to teach those skills, I think. And especially with more and more mothers out in the workplace now, then they don't have the time to pass down homemaking skills. Or dads. I mean, I actually was taught by my stepdad how to cook, you know, created the time to teach me. And I'm lucky, because if he hadn't have done that, I would have been starting from scratch and having to like really muddle through in the early years.
Mm.
That's what I want to provide, really, is a sense of somewhere where people can learn those old school homemaking skills.
Well, that certainly was an interesting one. How would you feel about being a traditional wife? If you want to have your say, head over to the Real Fix Facebook page, where plenty of women are getting involved with their own opinions. Just search for us online. You're listening to the Real Fix podcast, and you're very welcome. If you want to hear more stories like this, click subscribe or follow on your favourite podcast platform. Next up, we have Blessing and Michael from Hertfordshire. Now, this pair met 11 years ago and got married 2 years later. They had a very healthy sex life until their baby Ivan arrived. And despite welcoming their bundle of joy with open arms, they found their sex life dried right up. Eager to get back in the sack, the couple not only rolled out training dates for other couples, but began to rate each other's performances at home. Blessing and Michael spoke to Harriet Rose Gale, Lucy Bryant and Holly Sawyer about the wonders it did for their relationship.
So the sex training started before the kids.
So I think it started on holiday one time in Morocco.
Yeah.
So we were having one of our YOLO moments, and we went to Morocco for a weekend. And I think it was during what, one morning we're a little bit bored and we thought, you know what, let's have a training session. And you would just thought, okay, what does that entail?
And the thing is, when I was like, let's have a training session, but we're very like methodological. So we're very methodological with everything we do. So we write contracts, we, you know, do everything. So for example, Mike wanted me to write, so it's a little bit of a digression. Mike wanted me to write a bit of a contract to, you know, to style him or anything like that. So anything, whenever we want to do something, we have contracts, or we use our decision wheel. We have a decision wheel which helps us if we've got
which eliminates conflict.
Yeah, it eliminates conflict. So we'll just use the decision wheel and it helps pick stuff.
But the contracts, basically, there's a particular contract that's really important, I think, anyway. It is, I'm relatively considered quite a stylish guy, but it's because of this woman, obviously. And I made sure that I don't care where you are in the world, you will style me. So in a legally binding contract, so she can't get out of that.
What's she going to do if she breaches it? Are you going to sue her?
Yeah, I've actually had this conversation with him quite a few times, actually. Like, even when we're arguing, I'm like, I'm never styling you ever again.
I'm like, you're on the contract, you can't do that.
So with this training session, we felt like things started to get a bit repetitive.
Yeah.
So we needed to add some stuff. And Mike has a thing for reading Cosmo a lot.
Oh, so, nice.
Yeah, he reads Cosmo so that he skips to the sex part and basically tries new things. And I said, you know, we should do sex training sessions where we try the things out, we write down notes, we write down the notes, we talk to each other about the notes, then we scrap it, you know, we scrap the notes, throw them away so that we don't focus on the negativity.
Yeah.
But that's basically what we do. So we'll write up, we always have the notepad next to us, but it's not like we keep the notes. We never keep the notes because we don't. Sometimes, you know, if you're in the moment and you're enjoying sex and you're enjoying the intimacy, you won't get, you know, you're not going to get emotional about criticism. However, you know, if you're pissed off and you're reviewing your notes, you're like, actually, remember that time, you know.
This happened before.
Yeah.
I'm talking from experience.
So that's why we scrap the notes. So basically we review the notes, then we try, you know, the feedback.
And then we go through the actual session.
We go through the session and then we scrap the notes so that we're not focusing on any negativity. That's basically what we do.
Okay. So essentially how it would work is, let's just say, for example, on one occasion, I've read something in Cosmo about, the flying monkey position. Just to say, for example.
Just
right?
Random. He's just saying something random.
And,
yeah.
And I read up on it and I'm like, that's interesting. So I come home like, babe, we need to book a training session because I just read something in Cosmo and I think you might like it. So, you know, set the scene, turn the lights off, get the lamp on,
candles,
you know, nice, get a nice ambiance in the room. And then, you know, I'll you know, revise what I read and then I'll try it. And I'll be like, how do you like that? And she'll be like, okay.
And what kind of, what kind of things are you writing in the notepad? So what kind of notes are you making?
So basically we'll write something like, just the new methods, for example, you're sucking too hard or you're kind of licking aimlessly.
Okay. You need to kind of be a bit more gentle.
Yeah.
Or bite me a little bit harder.
Yeah. Or kind of like put more pressure, you know, on the balls, or put more pressure on them. You know.
By the way, this is we can like be free on this, right?
Yeah. Please
do. Yeah.
No filter.
We know that we'll say, okay, so during that new method, you need to make sure that you use a bit less tongue less licking. Maybe you should add some fingers after XYZ, you know.
And then we'll review that and then we'll scrunch it up and then take that feedback, hold it mentally and then go for it. And, you know, 9.5 times out of 10,
it's pretty good.
All the
time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that way it keeps things new, fresh.
Yeah.
We never go through a session where I don't have multiple orgasms and he's not fully satisfied. Yeah. So we never had a session where it was kind of just like, oh, that was rubbish. You know, it's always been, it's always exciting, and it's always something that we look forward to. Every time we make love, we're like, yeah, that's so exciting.
Except if I'm really, really drunk.
Oh my gosh.
if I'm really drunk, for some reason they just never finish.
He is a mess. And the thing is, he always wants to do it when he's drunk. I'm just like, I can't be asking you.
But sometimes, because in my mind, I'm like, my mind says sex. So, you know, I'm like, babe, let's do this
I'm
kind of thing.
Like, and I'm just like, no. I'm like, no.
Babe. Let's stop. And it gets to the physical part, and it's like nothing.
And I'm literally rolling my eyes. I roll my eyes. I'm just like, you do this all the time. Why do we even bother?
You should make a contract that you have no drunk sex.
Sober sex only.
She's the horn bag. Don't get it twisted. She wants it too. So
yeah, I'm a little bit of a touchy feely horny drunk.
She's a horny drunk.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's not a good combination, really.
I'm a
loud
drunk.
So I can be loud and I love everyone. I mean, I'll be like, guys, I love you.
Yeah.
I'm that guy. Yeah. And she's like, get your hands off me, take me to the bathroom type of drunken person.
There we go. So how's your relationship kind of changed since you've introduced the sex training days?
I think
it was introduced quite early on though.
Yeah, I think in the areas of sex, unless there's other external factors, for example, if any one of us is feeling a particular way, in the areas of sex, we're pretty confident and we're always, we're always trying to find ways to keep it interesting
and exciting.
Yeah. So even like if we're not having training sessions, we're always trying new things, or we're trying, you know, or we're trying to, you know, ask different questions and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it's like always a continual thing. It's not that we're waiting for a training session. It's just like, you know, every time I'm, you know, performing my actions on Blessing,
we're communicating about it.
I'm like,
communicating to each other what we like and what we don't like. And the thing is like, before we had kids, a training session would be a day, so we'll spend a whole day training on each other. And now with the kids, we probably do it like during nap time and bedtime.
I mean, our kids are really good at sleeping. They're sleep trained, so they go to sleep at 6:30, and they're out through the night, so they don't wake up again until about seven in the morning.
Mm, that is impressive.
Well, you're lucky parents.
So we can, if we know, once they go down, we're like, yep, training session.
Do this.
Yeah, so how frequently are you kind of doing them now then?
Once a month. Before, we used to do them about twice a month, because, once a month. The thing is, the reason why we do them twice a month is just because they're fun.
Yeah.
You know, they're fun, and we'll probably just add a board game.
We switch up the format a bit. So maybe we have a particular board game that I can't remember the life of me what this game is called.
It's from Ann Summers.
And it's upstairs. We've got it from Ann Summers.
Yeah.
And, we use, there's particular scenarios in this board game that says, oh, perform an act on your partner for 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And sometimes we'll take that as an opportunity to try something new.
Yeah.
And so that's...
Yeah, or role play.
Or role play, or we just incorporate it into that. So it's not just like your bog standard classroom, take notes, throw it away. It's sometimes kind of mixed up, because it's meant to be fun, not too serious. So if it's too serious, then it just takes the fit out of it.
It does need to be a little bit serious, though.
I mean, a pinch of seriousness in the sense of remember what
because
you're doing.
Because you don't want the partner to do it, and you take you've given them the feedback, and they're like, okay, I've taken your feedback on board, and then they do it again, and you're like, wait, what about the feedback I gave you? Like, you're still doing the same rubbish, you know?
Wow, they certainly sound chipper. Blessing and Michael there with how they reinvigorated the spark into their relationship. And that's it for this episode of the Real Fix podcast. I hope you've enjoyed it. Thank you for listening once again. And don't forget, you can read more of our stories on our website, real-fix.com. And do follow us on Twitter and Facebook at RealFixUK. And if you like this, please give us a 5-star review. If you've got a story for us, do get in touch. See you next time.